the headlines, the U.S. formally begins withdrawing its remaining troops from Afghanistan to end what President Biden had described as a forever war. India reports a record daily rise of over 400,000 coronavirus cases as the country begins its inoculation drive amid shortages of vaccines. And the UN expresses concern over Bahrain's use of force against a peaceful sit-in in one of its jails after the death of a political prisoner. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The United States has formally begun withdrawing its remaining troops from Afghanistan. American helicopters were seen flying over Kabul and nearby Bagram Air Base as Washington geared up the pullout process. U.S. officials also confirmed the troop withdrawal, saying that May 1st is just a continuation. American forces were scheduled to leave by May the 1st under a deal signed between the Taliban and the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The Taliban accuses Washington of violating the agreement. However, incumbent President Joe Biden has promised to end what he called the forever war. He has declared all troops will be out of Afghanistan by September. The U.S. invaded the country in 2001 with a so-called War on Terror slogan, but despite two decades of his presence, the U.S. failed to quell violence and ensure security in the war-torn country. Amin Alami says the U.S. troop withdrawal will leave the Taliban without the slogan of fighting foreign occupiers that they used to justify their attacks.
It seems that with the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan, there will be no place for many issues or slogans for the Taliban, mainly for jihad, because there would be no foreign invader or there would be no foreign occupier. That is why the Afghan government and mainly the people of Afghanistan call on the Taliban to say yes to the demands of the people, that is bringing peace and stability via launching a direct negotiations between the main local players.
India set yet another global record in its daily coronavirus cases, registering more than 400,000 infections as hospitals are running out of beds, oxygen, and vaccines. The Federal Health Ministry also reported a record 3,500-plus fatalities in the past 24 hours, bringing the country's total death toll to over 211,000. The Asian nation has seen an alarming rise in cases and deaths since mid-April. Its total caseload now stands at over 19 million, second only to the United States. On Saturday, the country expanded its vaccination drive to all adults, despite many states reporting to be running out of stocks. Until now, only frontline workers like medical staff, people over 45, and those with existing illnesses have been inoculated. Hospitals and healthcare facilities have been overwhelmed with patients. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman says the vaccination pullout or rollout is not well managed and has drawn large-scale criticism of the government.
The vaccination drive that was rolled out has completely failed because the vaccination was not rolled out in a proper or in a well-managed or well-mannered way because there were lots of gaps and lots of issues with the vaccination drive. When the government said that they will start vaccinating a certain age group of people and the frontline workers, etc., it has drawn a large-scale criticism because if we remember, when the country started vaccinating its population, it also started exporting the vaccination, which many believe was the biggest setback the country is facing right now. Well, last October, when the country thought that the virus is retreating, they started thinking that we will be the first nation to export vaccination to most of the countries. But what is right now the biggest trouble and the biggest challenge for the government is the vaccination, because they don't have the vaccine shots right now. Till now, only 9% of the population has been vaccinated.
As India grapples with COVID-19 crisis, Kashmir has also seen an unprecedented surge in COVID cases, prompting authorities to impose a lockdown in the region. Sait Ali Safi has more in the following report from the Indian-controlled Kashmir.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region. Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone, sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than four people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis. And there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Sayyidi Safir, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The United Nations has once again called for the restoration of democracy and an end to violence in Myanmar. In a statement, the UN Security Council urged the release of all, including Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who were detained after the February military coup. The statement followed a warning by the UN Special Envoy about the deteriorating situation in Myanmar. Christine Schreiner Berkner expressed concerns over the resurgence of ethnic fighting, hunger, poverty, and difficulties in consolidating power. Last week, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, also called for dialogue aimed at ending the crisis. Myanmar has been in a political turmoil since the military takeover of power. Concerns grow over the junta's intensified crackdown on protesters, demanding the return of civilian rule. The UN Human Rights Office says that it is disturbed by Bahraini police's use of force against a peaceful sit-in in the kingdom's main prison. The spokesperson of the organization called the violent repression in the notorious Jiao prison unnecessary and misappropriate. She called on the Bahraini government to immediately launch a thorough and effective investigation into the incident. Prisoners started their sit-in on April 5 after the death of a political prisoner who was reportedly denied timely access to essential health care. Activists say the security forces used heavy-handed tactic against prisoners, beating and injuring them. The Bahraini regime faces criticism over the situation of its prisons amid the coronavirus crisis. The appalling prison situation has also sparked protests among the families of the detainees. Palestinians have held a mass rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their support for ongoing protests in the occupied West Bank and condemn the Israeli crackdown on Palestinians. Ruby Akram reports from Gaza.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized the mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territories.
People here in the Gaza Strip stress on their support to Palestinians in the holy city of Jerusalem al-Quds. They say they are ready to sacrifice themselves in order to defend the integrity of Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
U.S. National Security Advisor says the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are in, quote, an unclear place. Jake Sullivan's comments came as Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal are set to hold another round of talks in the Austrian capital. Sullivan said that all sides, including Iran, have shown serious willingness to take a pathway back into the deal. However, he said it is still uncertain whether the process culminates in an agreement. Representatives of Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the EU have already held three rounds of talks. Tehran has repeatedly said that it would only accept the outcome of the talks once Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Iran also says that it will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Top European Union officials slam Russia and threaten to take countermeasures after Moscow imposed entry sanctions on eight EU officials. The heads of the European Council, Commission, and Parliament said that they condemned the sanctions in the strongest possible terms. EU chiefs said the entry bans are unacceptable and entirely groundless. Moscow announced the measure on Friday, retaliation for the EU's bans on four senior Russian officials. The travel bans target the head of the European Parliament and the vice president of the European Commission, among others. Tensions have been running high between Moscow and Brussels over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny last year. Moscow rejects any involvement, saying that the EU is hyping things to pressure Russia. Political commentator Bill Jones gave us his thoughts on the tense situation between the EU and Russia.
I think the EU decision is a tremendous mistake. There's a lot going on now which is aimed at really getting at Russia, including the so-called sudden discovery of Russian espionage in the Czech Republic. The Bulgarians have jumped on board, and the whole European Union is geared up in this campaign against Russia. I think there are a lot of dissenting voices, however, in Europe, and particularly in Germany, which is not interested in creating a conflict on European soil. But the real question is here in the United States, that if the U.S. Convinces the Europeans or can pressure the Europeans to move against Russia, then it becomes kind of a very difficult situation that can lead to military conflict very easily. And the danger is that people may think that they're moving forward with a lot of leeway before it leads to military conflict, and then suddenly they have crossed a red line which they were unaware of or ignored, and then it becomes a military conflict. And of course, the situation in Ukraine at the moment is the most serious, even though the Russians have withdrawn troops from the border. This is a flashpoint for a conflict. And if the wrong moves are made and the wrong things are said, this can really set things off. We don't know what that breaking point is going to be. The only thing we can say that if we don't get off of this course is going to lead to war.
With the onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic last year came an increase in hostility and racial abuse against Asians, and the Chinese community in Britain was no exception. As Saeed Purizar reports, some of the abuse has been leveled against the very people putting their own lives on the line to save others.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians. Hate crimes against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But, you know, some people are still going to say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they're receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years. And an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
A disproportional number of them, drawn especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saeed Puriza, Press, London.
And that is for World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
At $778 billion U.S. military expenditure, 4.4% higher in 2020 than in 2019, accounted for 39% of the world total. Despite growing demands made by progressive lawmakers and activists to redirect funds from the Pentagon to impoverished communities nationwide to promote human and environmental flourishing, Biden earlier this month requested an even bigger military budget than the one approved last year. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under a heading, Global Military Spending Grew to Nearly $2 Trillion in 2020 Despite Pandemic. Here's more on that. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, worldwide military spending rose to nearly $2 trillion in 2020, according to an analysis published recently by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Global military expenditure in 2020, estimated to have reached $1.98 trillion, was 2.6% higher than in 2019 and 9.3% higher than in 2011, according to SIPRI's new report. A 2020 bump in military budgets was observed in Africa, that is 5.1%, in Europe, 4%, the Americas, 3.9%, and Asia and Oceania, that is 2.5%. The West Asia region was the only regional exception where there was a 6.5% decrease in military spending in the 11 countries for which data is available. SIPRI researcher Diego Lopes da Silva told AFP that last year's growth in world military expenditure, which coincided with a 4.4% decline in global gross domestic product, was unexpected. Because of the pandemic, one would think military spending would decrease, he said, but it's possible to conclude with some certainty that COVID-19 did not have a significant impact on global military spending. In 2020 at least. Given that military spending continued to escalate during an economic downturn, SIPRI found that the global military burden, or military expenditure, as a share of GDP grew from 2.2% to 2.4%, the largest annual increase since 2009 financial crisis. A substantial percentage of global military spending in 2020 was driven by a handful of countries. According to SIPRI's analysis of the data, 62% of the world's military expenditure was attributable to just five countries. When the military budgets of Saudi Arabia, Germany, France, Japan, and South Korea are added to the tally, these 10 countries accounted for $1.48 trillion, or 75% of the world's total military expenditure last year. With a military budget of $778 billion in 2020, the U.S. alone was responsible for 39% of the world's total military expenditure last year. Although other top spenders all increased their military budgets last year, including China, India, Russia, and the UK, the United States continued to lead the surge in militarism, spending 4.4% more in 2020 than in 2019. Alexandra Marksteiner, a researcher at SIPRI, said in a statement that three consecutive years of increased U.S. military spending reflects growing concerns over perceived threats from strategic competitors such as China and Russia, as well as the Trump administration's drive to bolster what it saw as a depleted U.S. military. The U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 countries combined, according to the Institute's for Policy Studies National Priorities Project. In addition, military spending accounts for more than half of the federal discretionary budget, even as U.S. voters support reallocating a portion of the Pentagon budget to healthcare, education, housing, and renewable energy. SIPRI noted in its report that while military spending rose globally, some countries explicitly reallocated part of their planned military spending to pandemic response, such as Chile and South Korea, which is precisely what U.S. campaigners have been urging President Joe Biden and Congress to do. Despite growing demands made by progressive lawmakers and activists to redirect funds from the Pentagon to impoverished communities nationwide to promote human and environmental flourishing, Biden earlier this month requested an even bigger military budget than the one approved last year. While the White House has been provided with specific proposals for how to slash the Pentagon budget and actually improve national security, Lopes da Silva said the Biden administration has not given any indications that it will reduce the military spending. As Carly Town, co-director of the anti-war group Code Pink and coordinator of the Defund the Pentagon campaign, stressed last month, cutting the Pentagon budget and reinvesting in the needs of our communities is not only morally necessary, it's also urgent if we are going to address the biggest threat that faces our planet, that is climate change. The Pentagon is the world's single largest consumer of oil and one of the world's top greenhouse gas emitters, Town added. If we are going to take the future of our planet seriously, we need to cut the Pentagon budget now.
The debate.
In his first speech to Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden said, "We're in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century." The U.S. president said he's not seeking to worsen relations with Beijing and called diplomacy the best way to deal with disputes, but also said the U.S. will maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific. Beijing, for its part, has urged the U.S. to stop an upward trend in its military activities in the air and seas near China, which threatens regional peace. Joe Biden also said his country would stand up to China's unfair trade practices, accusing Beijing of intellectual property theft. Biden has maintained a tough anti-Beijing stance inherited from the previous administration, which also includes more visible support for Taiwan. This has infuriated China, which deems the island as part of its territory. The two countries are also locked in a years-long trade war. Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, Mr. John Pfeffer, who's joining us from Washington, D.C. Also, we have National Security Analyst Brian Downing joining us from Florida. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Pfeffer in Washington, D.C. On Wednesday, Joe Biden said that the U.S. was in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century. Please unpack that for us.
Well, the United States has for, well, a couple of decades identified China as kind of the leading challenger to its international global power in the world. And this has proven to be a kind of focal point for U.S. economic and strategic thinking. In other words, the United States is currently kind of reorienting its military away from the war on terror, the endless wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and toward great power competition, China being perhaps the most important of those competitors. But it's also economic, of course, as China has become, according to several standards, the most powerful economy in the world. And so this is something that the Biden administration, as you pointed out, has to a certain extent inherited from the Trump administration, but also from the Obama administration as well.
Mr. Downing, in Florida, Biden said that he doesn't want a conflict with the world's second largest economy, but the U.S. will stand up for its fundamental trade rights. China has frequently maintained that a U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, East China Sea, and Taiwan Strait is the main destabilizing factor in the region. Talk to us about the tensions under the new U.S. administration and who is threatening the stability of the region.
Well, you know, China is the rising economic power. It will be the most powerful economy in the world, and, you know, the estimates vary, but it's going to happen within 10 or 20 years. It's inevitable. And along with that growing sense of power, they want to show it symbolically, and historically one of the most important ways to do that has been through using your military, specifically your Navy, I think. You remember there was a time when the British Navy ranged from Europe through Caribbean, the Suez Canal, the Persian Gulf, Straits of Malacca, Hong Kong, everywhere. And then the United States, 100 years ago, Theodore Roosevelt sent the Great White Fleet around the world. It was a symbol that the United States was coming on and that Europe was a declining area. Well, China feels the same way towards the United States and wants to show it symbolically. I don't really think there's that much threat of an overt war between American and Chinese forces or even a major conflict. Remember, throughout the Cold War with the Soviet Union, we always heard, well, these incidents can get out of hand, and indeed they can. But through all that period, 1945 to 1991, things were pretty much held in check. There were hotlines. There were incidents. American and Russian naval vessels collided in the Mediterranean and elsewhere. So I really think it's a manageable thing. China, to my way of thinking, wants to dominate the world economically, establish its centricity in the world. Dominate might be too strong a word. Remember that in all recorded history, the Chinese economy has been the most powerful one in the world, except for two centuries, the 19th century and the 20th century. So to China, the West, the United States, these are historical aberrations that can and will be corrected in the next few decades. So I see it mostly as an economic conflict and not a military one. But as I said, incidents can happen.
Mr. Pfeffer, the Chinese Defense Ministry urged the United States on Thursday to rein in its frontline forces, which Beijing has said to have become more active in the air and seas near China this year. Why the increase in activity? What is the U.S. worried about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, often at the beginning of administrations, whether we're talking about the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, there's heightened conflict with China initially as the two superpowers get a measure of one another. Often that has given way to a much more pragmatic relationship, to economic negotiations, even to some security negotiations. This time around, the Biden administration comes in at a time when it frankly, has to focus on domestic issues. It has to revive the economy, has to get COVID under control. It is dealing with infrastructure needs. It has decided in large part to characterize those domestic transformations as equally necessary to combat a rising China. In other words, we need infrastructure development in the United States to compete effectively with China. At the same time, we're responding to some of the initiatives under the Trump administration to draw together alliances more closely to contain China. This is kind of the flip side of Biden's approach to multilateralism. I mean, there are two approaches, obviously. One is to work with other countries to deal with global problems. The second is to work with your allies and some other countries to contain your adversaries. And it's this second type of multilateralism that the Biden administration has continued from the Trump years, for instance, coordinating with the so-called Quad, the United States, Japan, Australia, India, to discuss ways of combating Chinese influence. working more closely with Japan and South Korea in, you know, a greater trilateral cooperation, drawing closer with some of our allies around the South China Sea, particularly Vietnam in this case, military allies suddenly after 20 or 30 years of adversarial relations. All of it designed to push back at China and push back at what is perceived as greater assertiveness from the Chinese government, greater nationalism from the Chinese government. And so I think all of this combines to contribute to the United States giving signs through various methods, military methods, that it is not going to be falling back in the Pacific, that it will continue to assert itself as a Pacific power.
Mr. Downing, responding to a question about Biden's speech, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry said the U.S. was merely feeling insecure and jealous about China's development. Those comments were made by Wang Wenbin. He said at a daily briefing that this is in nature, out of Cold War thinking, a zero-sum mindset, an ideological bias, and a sign of lack of confidence. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think there is, over the last few years, a sense of insecurity and resentment in the United States. That's something that just about every American knew for the last 75 years or so, that the United States was the dominant power in the world, is very much in doubt. And there are insecurities, resentments, and anxieties associated with that. But, you know, let's bear in mind that Chinese airplanes go fly over Taiwan airspace every day. They may be doing it right now while we're doing this interview. Their ships violate territorial waters of the Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries. So, you know, it's not as though China is just sitting back and building its economy and not doing anything to cause anxieties, fears, and concerns.
Okay. Mr. Pfeffer, China warned the U.S. against meddling in its internal affairs and threatened firm actions against U.S. interference in issues like Hong Kong and, of course, Taiwan, considering the congestion of forces in, above, and below the Taiwan Straits and the South China Sea. A conflict could explode by accident or even by design. Is a serious escalation over Taiwan imminent, in your opinion?
Well, I think I would agree with Brian that there's really not an imminent chance of military conflict in the United States and China, that both sides are eager to avoid any kind of significant escalation. As I said, the Biden administration wants to focus on rebuilding the United U.S. economy. China, of course, is focused also on not just economic progress within China, recovering obviously from the COVID crisis, but also building its One Belt, One Road initiative throughout the world. But at the same time, there's always a chance of unexpected escalation. This has been a threat now for a couple of decades, really. Expectation that some miscalculation in the Taiwan Strait or in the South China Sea will lead to an escalation. We've seen incidents in the past, whether it was the Downing of a U.S. plane by the Chinese during the George W. Bush administration, or more recently, Chinese moves in Xinjiang province, Hong Kong, domestically within their own country that have that the United States has strenuously protested against. Any of these could escalate, move out of control. But I don't think it's imminent. As I said, there really aren't not a lot of actors, even in the region, that are eager to see any such crisis take place. There's Japan, South Korea, even the Philippines, Vietnam. Whatever anger they might have over Chinese moves, they are not eager to have a full-fledged war
All right, Mr. Downing, you addressed this question earlier. Allow me to rephrase it. Is the U.S. willing to risk a serious escalation with Beijing when it comes to Taiwan?
Well, the question sort of presupposes some sort of hostile action by China towards Taiwan. As I said, they're flying planes over, but, you know, Russia's flying planes over Alaska, probably, as we're taping, doing this interview. You know, Taiwan is a very big island. It has a strong military. The place is well defended. If the Chinese attacked it, I don't know that China would win. Their navy would be highly vulnerable in the Taiwan Straits for several months as a ground campaign unwound. And they could take a beating from ship-killing missiles that Taiwan has, the United States, Japan, lots of people. The analogy I made in an article was the Battle of Okinawa during 1945, where an American fleet was outside of Okinawa, a pretty small island about 100 miles south of the Japanese mainland. And the United States, I don't have the numbers at hand, but I think the United States lost about 150 ships sunk or put out of action by the Japanese armed forces, mainly the famous kamikaze planes. If China did somehow take Taiwan or try to, I think the United States, the Quad that Mr. Pfeffer referred to, could cut off oil from the Persian Gulf very easily. Look at all the American military bases in the Persian Gulf. They could close it off in a matter of 24, 36 hours. There's nothing China could do there. If they send any ships to hostile action, they'd be sunk in a matter of hours. Furthermore, if China did do that, it's highly likely that South Korea and other countries would go nuclear. They are already nuclear, pretty much nuclear powers. They have the fissionable material. They have the warhead capacity. They have the missile systems. They're what's called a latent nuclear power. And I don't think China wants that. You know, something that could happen, there are a few islands owned by Taiwan that are maybe 5 or 6 miles, 10 kilometers off the Chinese coast. Kemoi Matsu, they're called the Tianmen Islands, I believe. Now, do a web search for those pictures. You'll see these islands with big fortifications and clearly visible in the background. You can see Chinese skyscrapers. So I think something we could see is for China to take those islands. They're utterly indefensible.
Mr. Pfeffer, let's look at this from another perspective. What is China's main priority in its relations with Washington?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think China has a number of priorities. The first, of course, is, as the spokesperson said, the United States should stop interfering in what China considers to be its sovereign territory, that China should, you know, that China just wants to do whatever it wants to do within its own borders without having to deal with certainly the criticisms of other countries, but also other forms of interference. So I think that's number one, and China has pursued a non-interference policy for decades. When it comes to the economy, you know, the Chinese would like to have, you know, free rein in terms of their actions around the world. They don't want to encounter any kinds of sanctions or additional tariffs or any other barriers to investment when they're looking towards, for instance, extracting raw materials from other countries or setting up various types of infrastructure projects. So that's number two. I mean, they definitely want to be able to get along more or less with the United States economically. The overlap with U.S. Interests comes to a point with environmental issues. China has done a pretty good job of addressing climate change issues or reducing carbon emissions within its own borders, closing coal-fired plants, for instance. It hasn't done such a good job in terms of encouraging that through its One Belt, One Road initiatives, through its infrastructure development projects. in part because they've been exporting some of the same kind of dirty energy projects abroad that they've been winding down domestically. But here's a possibility for overlap with the United States, and that is during the Obama administration, Beijing and Washington worked together on developing clean energy technologies through the Clean Energy Research Consortium. And that's still ongoing. It kind of fell under the radar, fell off the radar during the Trump administration, but it's still ongoing. It's conceivable that China and the United States could find greater common ground on such kinds of clean energy cooperation, research and development. So that's a third kind of priority.
Sure.
That we could see in U.S.-China relations.
Yeah, we're running short of time. Allow me to get one last question in for Mr. Downing. Very briefly, if you may, Mr. Downing, what happens? We've already seen the Biden administration's approach to China. It's been very hostile and antagonizing. What happens if China takes a no-compromise approach towards the U.S.?
I'm going to have to ask you to spell that out, what that non-compromising position would be. I don't know whether they're going to cut off American products from being sold in China. Two can play that game. Are they going to stop investing in the United States? That would be a pretty serious blow. I think what China wants to do is become the dominant investing power in the world. Second, it wants to be the dominant market in the world. If you want to sell your products in China, well, we're going to have some sort of political comedy there. Third, I think China wants to control natural resources, iron, copper, specifically rare earths. And if they control those, again, they can moderate the behavior of their opposition, including the United States.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, John Pfeffer, joining us from D.C. Also, thanks to National Security Analyst Brian Downing, joining us from Florida. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering it down some questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
The question of the day actually is the continuation of the question that was posed in our last show. So that's why we try to, inshallah ta'ala, continue to talk about and discuss that question again. And what was the question? The question was, what is a good plan or the best plan? What do you recommend for the rest of the days and months that we have in year to be benefited from the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan? So we have only one golden month where Allah's blessings and bounties are showered on his beliefs, on his creatures. Now, how can we actually store these positive energy for the rest of the year? This was the question, and Sheikh Murtada Karmi, Islamic scholar, actually touched upon this issue to some extent, but we left the whole answer to be given and presented to you today. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome. We are listening to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, if we want to continue acting upon what we gain in the holy month of Ramadan, first we need to know what we can gain during this holy month. I mentioned that according to the verse of chapter Baqarah, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, reaching taqwa and God-weariness is the main purpose for fasting. And in a narration from the Holy Prophet reads that the best action during the holy month of Ramadan is to be away from maharim Allah, the forbidden actions. Now, there are some other spiritual things that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan, and then we can have a program for keeping them after the holy month of Ramadan. One of them is the fact that through fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, we are able to be much more careful about the day of judgment. Mm-hmm. In one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, وَذْكُرُوا بِجُوعِكُمْ وَعَطَشِكُمْ فِي جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَعَطَشَ. So as people being involved during the year in worldly affairs, we may not think about the day of judgment a lot, which is very unfortunate. But during the holy month of Ramadan, one of the spiritual gains is that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, through your hunger and thirst, remember your thirst and hunger on the day of judgment. So this is another a spiritual lesson that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan.
Very true.
Doing ihsan or benevolence. We know that the holy month of Ramadan is the month of paying charity and sadaqah. There are, many narrations about the virtues of giving ihsan, charity, sadaqah during the holy month of Ramadan. We can practice it during the holy month of Ramadan. It can become a habit for us, and then we can continue acting upon that after the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is taking benefit from the dawns, from the sahar during the holy month of Ramadan. Let me share sentences mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He says that in this busy world, if we are not able to take benefit from the time of Sahar or Dawn, we do not have any other time to have a privacy for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our heart, with our God. There is no other time. We are busy. We are busy. In 24 hours, a couple of hours, we are sleeping. In the times that we are awake, every person has some worldly affairs. So Ayatollah Khamenei continues to say that in the past, we had some opportunities to have such free time, but today, this is the force of the time. We have some new phenomena which were not there in the past. So according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the only time that we can have a privacy for ourselves and for our hearts between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is during Sahar or Dawn. Now, because of the fact that many Muslims, they get awake before dawn to eat suhoor. Again, it can become a habit for the believers to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. So taking benefit from this time is a gracious blessing of the holy month of Ramadan. But many people, unfortunately, from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they continue to get awake after Adhan al-Sawab to say the morning prayer. But it would be great if people can practice that during the holy month of Ramadan. And
wake up before Adhan.
Exactly, and to make it into a habit, doing tahajjud, night vigil. There are many stories, many statements by the great scholars about the virtues of night vigil. Maybe 10 minutes before Fajr, Adhan, it would be great. And gradually people can increase a time inshallah. So it is one of the great blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. The next point is reciting the Quran. Again, many Muslims, they do that during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that many people are able, through the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to do a khatb, to recite one juz every day, so that at the end of the month, they are able to read and recite the whole noble book of Quran. For 30 days, we are practicing that. Again, we can turn it and change it into a habit. Not one juz every day, at least 50 verses, according to some narrations. If not able, one page, two pages. I mean, we need to have this connection to the noble book of Quran. Ikhlas or sincerity is another spiritual...
So the next recommendation was to have this constant relation with the Holy Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as it has been recommended to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran per day, mm-hmm. at least in other days. While in the holy month of Ramadan, we should not suffice with even one juz of it.
It depends. I mean, if people have the time, we have about the scholars. I mean, for the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, for the Prophet, we have in the narrations that they used to do the khatm of the Quran several times during the holy month of Ramadan. We have the same stories about some of the great scholars. But maybe we can say, of course, this isn't a recommended act, but maybe the minimum which is expected from the believers is to do at least one khatm during the holy month of Ramadan and continue to have this connection with this noble book after the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned again, many people, unfortunately, right from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they forget about everything. They forget about paying charity, about, Salatul Layl, about reciting the Quran, and so on and so forth.
But Sheikh, this recitation of the Quran is very, I don't know, this is what I understood from the actually text of Hadith, from the tongue of the Hadith, or the language of the Hadith, that a person who does not recite 50 verses of the day will be included in the circle of ignorance, if I'm not mistaken, and the hadith goes well here. So we have to take refuge to God subhanahu wa ta'ala for this. And at least we need to oblige ourselves to recite Quran. As for tahajjud, I have also another point to mention. Is it enough, Shaykh, just to at least practice tahajjud with two rak'ahs, at least slowly, slowly, but later on, inshallah, it will become a habit for us and we shall perform the whole thing, I mean, with 11 rak'ahs.
Yeah, when it comes to tahajjud, I mean, the great scholars, they say that, first of all, it should be done in a gradual way, because we have seen some people that they begin by, for example, doing that for 1 hour or half an hour, but after 1 month, they get tired and exhausted, and they stop doing that altogether. Mm-hmm. So the point is that it should be gradual. For the first step, people may do that before going to sleep after, Shari midnight. I mean, naturally between 11, 12 p.m., it is the beginning of Shari midnight, and people can read the Salatul Layl from that time onwards, but it's better to be said before Adhan stops. So in the first step, some people may do that if they are not able to be to get up before Fajr prayer. But then, as you mentioned, the next step would be just waking up. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe for 1 week or 2 weeks, you just try and practice to be able to wake up.
That's true.
Next, just to make a wudu. I mean, it's been mentioned by some of the scholars. Next, just reading and saying two rak'ah prayer, and gradually you would increase that into 11 rak'ahs. And it's very important to be done gradually and not force our heart to do the recommended action that we are not, inclined toward that. If it is done gradually, we will feel that interest to doing that more and more.
So waking up at that time before Adhan by itself is very important.
Exactly.
And breathing in that atmosphere, in the environment actually by itself is actually influential in the human beings, but better to recite two rak'ahs, much more better to recite the whole thing, I mean,
exactly.
11 rak'ahs.
Yes. There are stories, quoted from the great scholars, and they are astonishing, good for the people who are able to practice that.